National Weather Service for this Wednesday, June the 7th. Sunny and pleasant. Today's high 72. Hurry for us. Sun is shining now. 62 degrees in Racine. 58 for Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasdiffs.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited about the opportunity to speak with Dr. Michael P. Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut, and the author of a fascinating new book called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Professor Lynch, for many, many years, has been interested in how we acquire knowledge and develop understanding, and about the ways in which this whole business of gathering knowledge and developing wisdom and understanding has been changed radically, and perhaps in some really disturbing ways undermined by some of the technical breakthroughs that have overtaken us at such a rapid degree. And of course, the way in which now we don't go to the bookshelf and we don't go to the lab, we go to Google to find out the answer to some question that we might have. And this is a new way of gathering information and gathering understanding that in some respects shuts us off from new experiences or maybe contrary evidence that might lead us to a deeper and more nuanced understanding of maybe a complicated issue. And of course, we find ourselves in a sharply divided America, and divided not only along lines of values and political attitude, but also divided sharply along lines in terms of what is real, what are the facts, what sources can I trust, and where is all this going to lead? And for those of us disturbed by this turn of events, what can we possibly do about it? Those questions and more posed in this intriguing book, again called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data, published by W.W. Norton. Professor Michael Lynch, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to be talking with you. I should mention a previous book of yours called In Praise of Reason, which touches on some of these same issues. Kind of an overarching question right off the bat. I wonder how astounded you are that so much of our human lives have been radically changed in such a short amount of time by the advent of the internet. Are you as astounded as I am that all of this has taken place so quickly?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, I'm 50, and that means that I've, like you, have lived through this change. And I think one of the things that really is astounding to people my age is that we, not only has it changed so quickly, but we've become acclimated to it so quickly. Right now, I am, you know, somebody who I tweet, I Facebook, I use Google all the time, and I use it not just in my personal life, but of course in my professional life as an academic, as a professor. And it's one of my main sources of information, and that's true for all my colleagues as well. So it's revolutionized the way that we not just relate to each other and talk to each other, but actually communicate, but how we acquire and disseminate knowledge. And that's one of the things that I think is truly astounding, how quickly it's done that. It's not the first such thing to do that. Of course, the printing press, the written word itself, revolutionized how we thought, how we remember, how we gain information, how we know. But the speed of this particular revolution, as you pointed out, is particularly astounding.
You say at one point in your book, the internet didn't create the problem, but it is exaggerating it. And I suppose, in a sense, exacerbating it. I mean, sometimes when we hear the word exaggerate, it means it's making something seem bigger than it is. And I think you're using the word exaggerate in a less common fashion here, meaning that it is worsening the problem, but it didn't create the problem. What created the problem, if not the internet?
Well, it depends on what we mean by what the problem is. I think if the problem that we're talking about, for example, is polarization, which is, you mentioned in your lead-in, which is a problem that I've been very worried about and still am, as I think many of the listeners will be, if that's the problem, the polarization, and not just polarization over values, but polarization over facts, which is the sort of situation we're in now, if that's the problem, then I think the deeper issue is really, two other things. One is human psychology, which is that humans, as psychologists tell us, are prone to what they call confirmation bias, which is just a way of saying that we like to go along with whatever information already agrees with our opinions. And that's something that, you know, in a sense, we don't need psychologists to tell us. We know that from our ordinary lives. If we're honest with each other, we know that we tend to pick out the voice in the room that's saying the thing that makes us feel good, agrees with our opinions. So confirmation bias is a fact about human psychology. The other aspect, the second thing, is a sort of philosophical attitude that I think is more recent, but particularly part of the problem or issue as well, polarization. And that's more ideological. It's philosophical. It's the idea that truth is something not so much that we discover through inquiry, but something that we can actually mold or create. It's the idea that reality is shapeable or can be shaped by us. And that's the sort of view that we can, in a sense, is both feeds into polarization and is partly a product of polarization. There's sort of a feedback loop. So we have people sort of thinking now, because there's so much disagreement over not just issues of values, as I mentioned, such as abortion or the death penalty, but over, you know, the size of inauguration crowds and over vaccines and over matters that we would have thought were straightforward matters of fact. There's so much polarization that people start to think maybe there really aren't any facts anymore, and maybe it really just comes down to just believing the person who has the loudest voice in the room.
Right.
So I think those are problems that pre-existed the internet. But what the internet does is it makes those problems, it amplifies those factors of our experience. Mm.
One of the interesting distinctions one can make as we read your book and think more deeply about some of these questions is by making more distinction between what information is and what knowledge is. And I think you are talking about knowledge not just being where your brain is this file box and it's stuffed with information and facts and knowledge and so on, but knowledge, the word knowledge implies something deeper, something with some grounding.
That's right. When we talk about it, we can actually make a couple different distinctions here that I think are helpful. On one hand, we can talk about data, which is really the raw material of our input, either into our computer or into our brains. And that raw material, once we give it meaning, is information. But information can be good or bad, true or false. So knowledge, when we talk about knowledge, what we're talking about is having the accurate information. But more than that, because you can have an accurate information through a lucky guess. Not knowing something isn't merely being lucky. It's having some, as you say, some grounds for your opinion, some evidence. And that, you know, for one of the things that was important for the development of science and that came out for, during the Enlightenment was the key notion of evidence, the idea that when you know something, you really have to have some evidence for your claim. And yet, of course, if you really do know it, it is accurate. You have evidence for it, and of course, it's a bit of information. So knowledge, I think, is a deeper thing than just information. But knowledge itself can come in different kinds. There can be the sort of knowledge one can have when one consults an expert. That's a sort of passive knowing. And that's the sort of knowing that we do in a way when we're when we consult good sources on the internet. But we can also know in a deeper way by grasping what how things fit together, grasping how things fit together, seeing their ultimate underlying causes. And when we do something like that, we're really what I engaging in a form of knowing I call understanding. And that's the most difficult form of knowing. It's the sort of knowing we really want to achieve in our lives, both about we want to understand our friends and family members. We want to understand our political foes. And we want to understand how the world works.
I think what you're suggesting, however, in your book is that there aren't enough people interested in going after that. And that's one reason why we find ourselves in this situation that I think you like to call knowledge polarization. Because if we don't have a hunger to understand complicated matters in a nuanced fashion beyond just what our own gut instinct tells us or our own personal experience, however limited it is, if we are content to know that and believe that and nothing more, and if I'm over here believing this and you're over there believing that, then we end up with this polarization on a whole different level than we have maybe seen before.
Exactly right. I think this is one of the deepest problems and most terrifying problems actually confronting us, because it's a problem that, as a culture, because it's a problem that if we can't solve it, if we can't solve the problem of knowledge polarization, then we're going to have a hard time solving the other pressing issues like climate change, for example, that we're facing right now as a society. Again, as you pointed out, the issue is that we not, in fact, it's even, I said earlier that we're disagreeing over facts, but it goes even deeper than that, because real knowledge polarization occurs when we're not just disagreeing over values, we're not just disagreeing over the facts, we're disagreeing over whose sources of evidence are reliable, what sources can be trusted, what standards and principles of evidence can be trusted. Once the disagreement gets that deep, when we're disagreeing over, for example, whether science is trustworthy or not with regard to, let's say, evolution or the age of the earth or vaccines, when we're disagreeing to that extent, then it's very difficult to see how to fight our way back to reason, to the light of reason, because, of course, anything I say in defense of my own views, if you're disagreeing with my methods and sources, you will find my claims to be sort of question-begging, because, of course, they're just relying on my own sources, and those are the things you're doubting. I think, you know, in the early days of the Internet, digital technology seemed to make knowing for ourselves, for example, so much easier. And in many ways, of course, it does. The Internet has become more of a part of our lives. You know, however, our use of it has become more passive. Much of what I think we know today, what I call in the book Google Know, we download prepackaged sets of facts and sort of push them along the assembly line of social media. And, you know, Google knowing is useful precisely because it's a sort of outsourcing. We offload our cognitive effort onto other people. And that's great because we don't have to clutter our minds, right, to remember certain facts. We just download them when we need them. But there's a really profound difference, right, between downloading sets of facts and understanding why or how those facts are the way they are. And really understanding why a disease spreads or how a mathematical proof works is an achievement. It's something that you work towards, and you can't just download it into your own sort of information bubble. Mm. And so these information bubbles that we're sort of curating for ourselves on social media end up feeding into the sort of passive way of acquiring information, and that can lead, I think, and
speaking with Michael P. Lynch about his book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. As I was reading about your book and what you had to say about Google knowing, knowledge acquired online, I realized that when I first read those words, I sort of took umbrage at them, because in my mind I'm thinking, well, what's the difference if I found this in World Book Encyclopedia, you know, a book sitting on my lap, versus online on a screen? But then I realized, the more I thought about it, I realized that the more we are Googling for information and online, which is this vast universe, most of which is unedited and in a sense unguided, that's where we really get into trouble, because everything is out on the internet, including all kinds of outlandish information, including all kinds of propaganda on both sides, and if that is the only place we go searching for information, we're almost bound to be filling ourselves with information that, in a sense, isn't worth acquiring.
Well, that can definitely be the case, and I think that a sort of basic truth of all of our lives right now is that the internet is both the world's greatest fact checker. You know, when we get in a dispute with somebody, what do? We race to the phones and, you know, try to Google it and find out who's right. So it's and that we all do that, and it's, even if we often think it's annoying when it's done to us, it is a way of fact-checking. But it's also, as I was saying earlier, that one of the world's greatest bias confirmer, and that's what you're getting at, is that it can basically, any particular bias or prejudice or view, crazy or not, that you have, you can find some support for it, or support in quotes, in air quotes, on the internet.
Right.
But, you know, the thing that you brought up a really good point, which is that what's really the difference between looking online and reading something in a book? Well, I think in one way, of course, there's a lot of similarities. When we go to we sometimes even think of the internet as a giant library where we just going and getting the books that we want. And to some extent, that's right. It is the case that libraries contain lots of information, some good, some bad, and so do encyclopedias. And the internet contains, in a certain sense, metaphorically, lots of information, both good and bad. But that's really where the similarity ends. Because actually, going onto the internet for information is, by its very nature, very different from going to a library. And let me explain. You could think about and I want to emphasize before I go on to explain that it's different, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily worse. In many ways, it's actually better. The big difference is what we might call the personalization of the internet. The internet doesn't just get us more information. It's not just a bigger library. What's the magic of the internet, the magic of Google, for example, is that it gets us precisely the information we want. And that's because our online life is personalized. You know, everything from the ads we read if you're reading the New York Times, the ads that'll come across your page online, to the political news in your Facebook feed, it's all tailored to satisfy our particular preferences. So it's easier than ever to get and share information, but the information we get often reflects ourselves. And that's due to how the internet works. The internet tracks the searches and movement that you, metaphorical movement that you engage in online, and that information is not filtered by any particular person, but by algorithms that allow advertisers to know what it is that you seem to be interested in,
right,
what you want.
You know, as you describe that, it reminds me of something a little contrary to that, but it's a very isolated information that when one goes to Wikipedia, the front page of Wikipedia, typically at the top, has some sort of article of the day, and it will be about Joseph Stalin or the
right.
Marriage of Figaro or
right.
the soccer player Pele, and it's not there on your screen because you asked for it. All you asked for was Wikipedia, but they just serve up this little article that has nothing to do with why you brought up Wikipedia in the first place. And in a sense, that's more like when you're reading yourself to sleep with a World Book, like I did as a youngster.
Exactly. Wikipedia is a much, you know, is in on the that in terms of the history of internet technology and information technology, Wikipedia is a very, very old-fashioned approach to things, which is funny to say because there was not too long ago where academics like myself got all worked up about Wikipedia. I personally think that Wikipedia is a very, you know, relatively speaking, a pretty good source of information. But it's old-fashioned because it isn't really as personalized as much of the other information we get online. When, you know, when the sort of apex of personalization, I think, came about with the advent of things like Google Complete, which is the very useful bit of algorithms that allows Google to literally know you so much that it can finish your sentences. So when you get online, right, and you type in a search, Google will prompt you. Will say, "Well, you're searching for shoes," and you know, and we'll help you try to finish that sentence. Is climate change a? And it might helpfully suggest, as it actually often does for people, a hoax. Is it real? Those sorts of questions. If you type climate, you can try that right now. Is climate change A, and see what you get from Google. What that does, of course, is direct people. So it does direct people. It is guided in a way. It's just guided by, in a sense, your own preferences and other people's preferences. That's what makes it so different from a library. It's as if the internet is like a library in this sense. You walk into a library and all the shelves change their contents. The books are different as you walk down the shelves. The books rearrange themselves in order to reflect what it seems, according to the library, you would like to see.
Mm.
And so that guidance is really coming from, in a sense, all of our preferences aggregated. And that's great if you're looking for shoes. It's not great if what you're trying to do is find some understanding, the sort of thing we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Because that, it sort of bumps up against a fundamental point that I think I emphasize in the book, and I think a lot of us deep down really think is important, which is that preference does not equal truth.
Right. And particularly, I was thinking, for instance, if we're talking about a vexing social ill like poverty, all the people in America that live in poverty, there are some people who, at the heart of their being, are operating from the presumption that the vast majority of these people have been, in a sense, given a raw deal, and by life or by life circumstances beyond their control, and if they just need a fair chance to do what they can do. And then there's others who operate from a different sort of gut feeling that the vast majority of these people are there because they sort of deserve to be there because they've made some stupid choices, they've made some stupid mistakes, they've undermined what might have been, you know, something successful by making some bad choices. And if we are looking at the same same population and the same problem, but starting with those two different sort of gut feelings, that will be the filter through which we take in all of the information after that to bolster our own understanding about why so many people are living in poverty. And we seem to see that over all kinds of different issues right now.
Exactly. And what the very same algorithms that allow us to get so much information that we want in order to do things like buy shoes or even look up a scientific article online, those same algorithms actually sharpen those filters that you were talking about, or to switch metaphors, they inflate our bubbles rather than bursting them. And that ultimately is what makes or should make us concerned about how we're learning things online now. I do want to emphasize that I'm not suggesting that we stop Google knowing. That, you know, absolutely not. It's too much of a part of our fabric of existence. In the same way, I wouldn't suggest that we stop reading or talking to each other. I mean, it's just a way that we acquire our beliefs now. Mm. But what I am suggesting is that we all start taking a little bit more responsibility for how we're engaging with information online and off. And
I think beyond that, you're also calling for all of us on whichever side of the aisle that we are on to approach all of this with greater humility. In fact, you are part of a research project right now, I believe, called Humility and Conviction in Public Life. Tell the listeners what this is about and the kind of humility that you would like more of us to acquire and with which to view the world around us.
Right, thanks. Yes, I here at the University of Connecticut, we are leading this this initiative to try to repair our fractured public discourse. And the way we think about it, it is through this concept, these concepts of humility and conviction. You know, you can't democracies can't function if the electorate doesn't have some commitments, some convictions. An apathetic electorate is no electorate at all. On the other hand, we also can't function if we're not willing to listen to one another, not just in order to wait our turn until it's time to talk, but to actually listen for the possibility of learning from each other. And that's the sort of what I call humility or intellectual humility that I think we really need to find ways of encouraging people to have in our culture right now. By this sort of humility, what I mean is being willing to see your own worldview as open to improvement by the evidence and experience that others might bring to the table. That's more than just being open, let's say, to change, right? It's more than just being interested in self-improvement. It's seeing the possibility that, you know, you could learn something from somebody who has different views on some fundamental matters than your own.
Right. And whether you are a staunch conservative or a bleeding heart liberal or someplace in between, that is, in this day and age, a fairly radical notion. And if more of us were willing to undertake that, I mean, and honestly, I mean, not just paying it lip service, but undertaking that kind of attitude in a very real way, think of the difference that could make.
Indeed. I think of it, I ask people sometimes to think of it in terms of what sort of attitudes towards themselves and towards others do you want your children to have? And certainly this attitude of intellectual humility, this willingness to see yourself as open to improvement, not, you know, with regard to your beliefs, that's and open to the evidence, those sorts of attitudes, those are the attitudes we really want to, and we do encourage in our children. And so those should be attitudes that we should work to encourage in ourselves. And so at the university here, we have teamed with 10 different groups of researchers around the world to look at how we can encourage and test ways of encouraging the adoption of this sort of attitude in our public discourse, whether we're talking online, as some of our researchers are working on, or if we're just looking into, as some researchers are working on with us, how the brain functions on dogmatism, so to speak, and how we can get, perhaps learn from that investigation, how the brain might function if it was actually being less dogmatic. So those are the sorts of things that we're trying to look into, and I encourage people listening to look at our website, Humility and Conviction, at the University of Connecticut.
Very good. We want people to also seek out your book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. And you are the featured guest in the next TED Talk. In 30 seconds, tell us about that.
That's about common reality and why we need to start believing in it again. Because otherwise, without a sense of common reality, there is no hope for engaging with each other in humility or with conviction. Hmm. We need to believe that we're all in one world.
Dr. Michael Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
that is the magnificent sound of the Bell City Brass Works, an ensemble with which I am well acquainted. In fact, not that long ago, I had the thrill of encountering them in person when the Bell City Brass Works played at Holy Communion Lutheran Church, which happens to be my church in Racine. And it was so great to be reminded of just how fantastic this group is. And they have been an important part of the musical landscape of Racine for 30 years. And in honor of their 30th anniversary, they have a very special festive concert that is coming up on Sunday, the 11th of June, 3 o'clock at Union Grove High School. And for this portion of today's morning show, I'm really glad to be speaking with the gentleman who stands on the podium and conducts the Bell City Brass Works, and I assume organized them 30 years ago, Doug Johnson.
Okay, well, I did not quite organize them 30 years ago. I played with the group for a little while back then. But,
oh, okay.
I was friends of guys that were in the program. It was a band that was formed from drum corps people, from brass musicians around the area that needed an outlet to play. There aren't many outlets for a lot of brass players to play, and this gave us a great opportunity.
Yeah. So are you saying that this wasn't your idea? This was someone else's idea?
No, this was Gary King and a lot of other people that were involved in those years in the past, yes.
Gotcha.
Jim Mertens.
And I see what you mean, that we have other groups around, like the Racine Concert Band and the Kenosha Pops Band, but they are mixed ensembles that are not all brass, and there's simply not enough room in either of those groups for every talented brass person.
No, we have 40 brass players in our group, and that would overwhelm any other group that's possible.
Clarinets wouldn't have a chance.
No, they wouldn't. And when we play with the symphony, too, that's also a very interesting thing. Count 100 measures of rest before we play.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Kind of nice to play the whole time.
Absolutely. No, so this is a great venue. So the Bell City Brass Works will be in concert on Sunday, and we'll talk about that concert in just a little bit. You yourself, Doug Johnson, coordinator of music for the Racine Unified School District and a well-known band director in the school district for many years. Where did you get your start as a brass player? And I know you as a trombonist. I assume that's the first instrument that you...
Yes, that was the first instrument I started playing. I started on trombone, I think it was with Ralph Trapp here in Kenosha, fifth grade at Lincoln Elementary.
Ah!
And continued through the schools. Had people like Jim Frost, Don Maley as my directors in the schools. Al Harris for a while. And then I went to UW-Parkside, was the first class at UW-Parkside.
Very first class.
Yeah, Dr. George Reynolds was our band director back then at that time. So
when it came time, I mean, back in fifth grade, for you to begin on the trombone, is that a choice you made or that somebody else made for you, that you and the trombone are meant for each other?
Well, that's a really interesting story. Actually, I wanted to be a drummer. I tried the drums, and I couldn't play them well enough, they said. I tried a trumpet, couldn't play that. Tried the clarinet. That wasn't working. And then I tried the trombone, and suddenly had this beautiful sound. And everybody said, wow, you really belong being a trombone player. I hadn't realized I had been set up, because the clarinet was set up in a way that I couldn't get a good sound out of it. The trumpet was set up so I couldn't get a good sound out of it. Because my parents had already gotten the trombone before I went for the tryout.
Oh,
so
is that right?
It was all planned out.
So these instruments were rigged to...
Oh, well, yeah, it was that. I think my parents wanted me to be on the trombone. My brothers played French horn and baritone, so they needed to finish the trio.
Wow. Of course, one of the things that, at a glance, sets the trombone aside, apart from any of the other instruments, is the fact that it has this slide that basically none of the other instruments have.
It is the only brass instrument that can be played perfectly in tune. It's God's instrument because it can imitate the voice more than any other brass instrument. In fact, I think Beethoven was the person that coined that phrase.
Huh.
The trombone was the only instrument that could play chromatically besides violin and voice. Up until that time. And then vowels were invented in the middle 1800s. And that allowed trumpets and baritones and French horns to do a lot more. The problem is they still can't be played perfectly in tune. Hmm. The trombone is the only one that can do that.
Right. So on a trombone, are there also valves? Or typically, is it just the slide?
It's typically just the slide. We do have valve trombones, but we also have rotary valves that are put on the instrument to add to the lower range of the instrument. So an F trombone, a B-flat trombone with an F attachment will be able to lower the instruments to lower pitches, and then you can add another one to lengthen the trombone bigger, to make it bigger, to make it a bass trombone.
Mm. I was just going to ask you if there's a family of trombones the way that there's, for instance, a family of trumpets.
Oh, yes, there is. And we have an alto trombone, which is the one that's most commonly used as the smallest instrument. They even have made smaller ones than that could almost imitate the trumpet sound.
Wow.
It's really going back in the history of trombones, because they were able to add a whole range of instruments that could play notes in tune, which and play chromatically, which before the 1850s, trombone was the only one that could do that.
Hmm. So all along was your aspiration to be a band conductor? I mean, when you ended up going to college and so on, is that what the career path was?
It was to be a teacher, really, was the reason I got into college, and music became the avenue that I could do that with, that I was most able to connect with students. There was a time there in my career, I think in my freshman year of college, I was very close to being in the Navy Academy and looking to be in the president's own band.
Wow.
I was looking forward to playing trombone professionally, and then we took a little turn there and decided, no, I think I really would rather be working with kids and education and making music as much as I possibly can.
Right. And, of course, for many years you were the band director at Park High School. Was that your first job with Racine Unified, or did you start someplace
else?
No,
I started at Washington Junior. The last year that building was in effect, and then I went to McKinley Junior High School for 4 years. And then I went over to Park, and I was at Park High School for the better part of the rest of that part of my career for the next 30 years. Mm. And then I also taught at Juristed for a short period of time in there, and then I got this job that I am now on, the Fine Arts Coordinator in charge of art and music.
Right. When you're teaching at the middle school level, generally, it just, I mean, whenever, I'm going to be insulting all junior high students now, but when I picture junior high students playing brass, I picture some shrimpy little kid with this huge brass instrument and them struggling to just create enough air to just make the thing work. Is it tricky to work with, for that matter, even younger kids? I mean, elementary kids and middle school kids? Or once in a while, do you have a student that is able to really make some great sound, even at that young age?
That is an interesting question. I know in the elementaries, I have taught elementary students, and it depends on how you start the student to really develop the proper embouchure to make sure they're blowing the air through the instrument properly. There are students that it is very, very difficult for them to play, and we try to get them onto a different instrument than a brass instrument. But the brass players, if they concentrate and focus on the mechanics of blowing the air through the instrument, they can go quite far with it, no matter how big or small they are. I've had very small children playing tuba and some very large young men playing trumpet, and it's amazing how fast and how far they can go once they get the basics down correctly. It's the breath support that you use for singing. It's the same thing for a brass instrument.
Right. And, of course, once a young person is really going to town on a brass instrument, it's so exciting what they can do. And I'm sure for them it's exciting, too.
It really is. And they can make an entire program at your school an excellent program just by their efforts. And the kids really, it's amazing how far that they can go. I remember some junior high school groups that I've heard in Kenosha and the groups that I've had in Racine that were just fantastic players, and these are junior high school students or middle school students. They're a very interesting lot to work with in middle school. They're a great group of kids. You just have to stay on your toes, and you have to keep moving along. You can't sit there and lecture for very long.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Doug Johnson, for many years a band director in the Racine Unified School District, and now the coordinator of art and music, and more for our purposes today, the director of the Bell City Brass Ensemble, which this year is celebrating its 30th anniversary, and they have a big concert coming up on Sunday, the 11th of June. Doug, is you mentioned the number of 40 when I suppose, yes, all hands are on deck, and in general, has that been how large the Bell City Brass Works has been over these 30 years?
The Bell City Brass Works has been between 25 and 40. I think 40 is about as large as we've gotten. A regular brass band, the English brass band that was developed in the middle 1800s, was 25 people exactly, and there was no more, no less.
Ah.
That's the style it was meant to be, with one E flat cornet, four solo cornets, two second cornets, two third cornets, a Repiano cornet, which is the same size as the other cornets, a flugelhorn, three alto horns instead of French horns, two euphoniums, two baritones, four tubas, and three trombones. I think that's 25.
Wow, so very particular sound.
Very particular size. In fact, when we've had some brass band people come to see our group perform, they say, well, you're not a brass band because you're too big, or you're using French horns. And we're going, we do what we do. And, and we use all cornets. We do not use trumpets, though.
Oh, and why is that?
It's a more mellow sound, a softer sound, doesn't have that edge.
So it wouldn't be not quite so overpowering.
And the music is written for that style. It really is written, most of the brass band music that was written in England and throughout the world has been written for that style of sound. That trumpet edge is an edge that just doesn't seem to belong in that. This gives it a more mellow style.
Interesting. How much does the membership of the group fluctuate from concert to concert? I know from gig to gig. I mean, like, I know not everybody played at Holy Communion a couple weeks ago, and I suppose even from concert to concert, there's some variance. How much?
We usually will vary 4 to 5 people in it, depending on sections. We do have students that are in the group. We have high school students that are in the group again this year that are 16 years old. We go up to age 85, and sometimes the high school students will have conflicts, or a college student will have a conflict. Or some of our members of the group that are band directors have concerts right near our date so that they can't do both. So we work our way around that. But we've got enough depth now that if two or three people are missing, we don't have a problem. If we had stuck with the 25 only, then I'd start having some problems because we'd always have someone missing.
And I suppose you have certain people that are in reserve for when...
No, actually, we don't have anyone in reserve. We have... That basic group of 40 right now, and that's really who we use. And if we're missing two or three people, we're usually in pretty good shape, or we can transfer somebody over to an instrument like an E-flat cornet or a flugelhorn or a euphonium or a baritone if we need to.
Yeah. You've already touched on this, but, of course, a lot of the people that are in this group are themselves band directors or brass instructors or so on, and I should think that gives the group a certain sort of special dynamic or chemistry, and also probably makes for an interesting challenge for you.
That's a good point. I know when I first started directing this group, I looked in front of me, and I've been used to directing high school students and middle school students, and to stand up in front of a group where, a third of the group are band directors or professional musicians, and going, okay, please do it this way, and realizing that I may have to change how I approach teaching with this group. They're a lot of fun to deal with, but it's kind of funny because we tell our kids to be quiet in rehearsal, and it's the same thing in the adult world. I mean, same sections do the same talking. It's just amazing.
That's right. Even the 85-year-old.
Oh, yeah. Even the 85-year-old or the other band directors, which is really a hoot to see that happen.
Right.
But they're excellent players, and they really want to make a great sound. And they'll occasionally offer some ideas of things of music that we should do or things that they've heard. And it's a great resource to have this coming back and forth.
Absolutely. I know it's primarily Racine, but I mean, my friend Kevin Velvicus, for one, is in the trumpet section, and he's from Kenosha. What is the split of Racine versus Kenosha versus maybe even other communities as well?
Okay, we have people all the way from Waukesha coming in, from Burlington, from Union Grove, from Kenosha. I would say we're about 60% Racine, about 30% Kenosha, and other outlying areas. It is quite a cross-section of people. Quite a few of them are not professional musicians. They have a regular job at a regular company here in Racine or in Kenosha, and they'll come in and play that night. There are people that are retired that are still playing. There are people that haven't played for 20 years that I've conned into coming into a rehearsal, and after they play for a couple of weeks, they just stay, and they enjoy playing, and they get their lift back, and they can start playing again.
Right.
It's a lot of fun.
But we should clarify, I think you have to play at a certain level to be, I mean, this isn't just whoever wants to show up with their trombone.
That's true. You have to have had at one time that ability to play at a high level. Now, not everyone does in the group, but everyone gives that a high level of effort, and that makes it all work, as long as people are willing to really work at it. But this is not a place to go if you're learning how to play an instrument.
Right.
The first rehearsal will kind of wake them up to the fact that they need to go home and practice.
So this concert coming up on Sunday, I think, is a nice indication of what you guys often do, in that there's some substantial music here, and there's also a lot of things that are just plain old crowd pleasers, and not that those are necessarily simple to play, but it's going to be a very entertaining concert. Just give us a few highlights of what's going to be played on Sunday
afternoon. Well, we'll be starting with George Gershwin's Strike Up the Band to start the concert, which seemed rather appropriate thing to be doing. And it's kind of funny because some of the Brassworks music that we have is a style that would be dating back into the 1800s, again, using some classical pieces, again, using Gershwin, of Summertime, Irish tune from County Derry, a Percy Grainger piece, and a lot of the English music that was written for bands were written for brass bands. It was only until the early 1900s before the music started to be written for a full band. We are using quite a few of our own soloists, too. This has been a concert that we've kind of morphed into using our own musicians as soloists, because every one of these people can really stand on their own. We have Jack Plavonic and Katie Poole on Softly As I Leave You, a beautiful euphonium duet. First time we did that was with Stephen Mead many years ago, who's a famous euphonium player out of England, that we were very happy to have him with us. He did a couple concerts with us, but we've always wanted to do this piece, and we saved the arrangement just in case we could get somebody to do it. It's kind of fun to have a father-daughter duet on a number like that.
Of course. Sounds like a really nice program, and it's is this ending the season or beginning the season?
Actually, this is near the end of our season. Then we do the two 4th of July parades, the one in Kenosha, and we also do Union Grove and Waterford parades. And that ends the season, and then we kind of close shop for a little while, start up the first week of September or the last week of August, and get ready for our November concert, which is the big guest soloist concert where we bring in some of the top people in the country. This year we're bringing in Marty Erickson, who's the principal tuba player with the Battle Creek Brass Band out of Battle Creek, Michigan, which is considered one of the finest brass bands in the world. And he's the principal tubist with them. He is also at Lawrence University as an instructor there.
Not too shabby. That's great. Yeah, and you've certainly brought in some big guns over the years. So if people want to attend Sunday afternoon's concert in Union Grove, can they buy tickets at the door, or should they be getting tickets ahead of time? Or
they can probably get tickets from people like Roger Palmer Chevrolet in Union Grove. I know they do have them available. We also have some, I think, at the music stores. Kevin and Velvicus will probably have it at Pacetti's Music. In Racine, we would have it at Schmidt Music. But you can also get them at the door, and the cost is free. You come on in, just get a ticket, and come on in. We do not charge for this concert whatsoever. It's sponsored through Roger Palmer Chevrolet.
Ah.
And if you notice, at the end of the concert, we have the piece entitled Music, See the USA, for Chevrolet. We run that ad every year, and it's arranged by one of the founders of the group, which I neglected to mention earlier, Ken Norman, who does many of our arrangements for the group. Ken is quite the composer. I've known him since my first days of college back at UW-Parkside.
Wow, very fun. Well, what a nice way to celebrate the 30th anniversary of a really first-rate organization, the Bell City Brassworks. And at the helm, Doug Johnson. Doug Johnson, great to connect with you, and best wishes with Sunday's concert. I plan to be there, and I know I'm going to enjoy it, and I hope a lot of people will come out as well to hear some great brass music.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll talk about the Fresh Ink Festival, which is going on right now at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And we'll also be previewing for you performances.